It's your phone. Or better yet, designate a texter. For more text-free driving tips, visit stoptextstoprex.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
Medford 91.5 FM. It is The Big Picture. Derek Gary with you until 9 o'clock tonight. 855-915-9636 is the telephone number. 855-915-9636. You prefer words to numbers? That's 855-915-WMFO. Punch that number into your phone. Give us a call. We love to hear from our listeners. Shay Spillane is not here. Shay Spillane went and booked herself a comedy gig. We have one rule on the show. Do not book your comedy gig on Wednesdays, because that's when we're doing the show. Well, Shay went and booked herself a comedy gig, so she is off this week. I am here this week. I will be with you, as always. On the Town will be here with you, as always, at 9 o'clock, bringing you everything you need to know about the Boston music scene. And we will have fun tonight. At some point, I guarantee you, we will have fun tonight. Coming up later tonight, we're going to be talking about the internet and a document that was unearthed by Axios, which is a technology website started by the founder of Politico, which is a position paper, a draft position paper by a Democrat, offering some ways that we might control the internet. Probably won't surprise you to hear that I don't find many of his suggestions workable. But before we get into all of that, we're going to talk about banning people on the internet as well tonight. I'm not going to go fully into that story just yet. I'm going to ask you to bear with me, because if I told you what that story is actually about, I think a lot of you would just switch off right now. And you don't want to do that. Believe me, you do not want to do that. But I want to talk about something to sort of set the stage tonight. And what I want to talk about is the American Civil War, which to many of us is ancient history. You know, the American Civil War, 160 years ago now, hasn't been anything remotely close to it since. Why would we even bring this up? Why would you even talk about the Civil War? Well, because I think there are some things that we need to understand about the American Civil War and how the American Civil War happened. And all of this loops around to other stories that we're going to talk about tonight. And you may be anticipating the conclusion that I'm going to come to, but let's start at the beginning with this. The American Civil War, in the eyes of most Americans, was a war between the North and the South over slavery. That's how it's presented to us in school. And we think of the American Civil War in terms of battlefields. We think of it in terms of Sherman paying a visit to Atlanta. We think about General Hooker marching his way into the South with his endless trail of followers. If you've read a lot and know a lot about the Civil War, you may think of the people who came down and had picnics on the edge of the battlefield. Or you may know that a lot of the early photographs of the dead on the battlefield were staged by the photographer. And that gave rise to standards in photojournalism. But what do you know about when the American Civil War began? When did the American Civil War start? Most people will tell you it started at Fort Sumter. It started when the South attacked Fort Sumter. That is not when the American Civil War began. That is when the shooting portion of the American Civil War began, after the South had seceded, after Lincoln had been elected. The South attacked Fort Sumter because they wanted the weapons and they wanted the territory, and the Union fought back. And that one flashpoint, that one incident, led to a massive, massive rallying of troops on both sides, and was fueled in part by a belief in the South that Europe would rally to their defense, that France would come swooping in to help them, or maybe England would come swooping in to help them. As it was, no foreign nation ever recognized the Confederate States of America. They were on their own. But the Civil War did not begin at Fort Sumter. The Civil War did not even begin with the election of Abraham Lincoln. The Civil War began years before those events. And it began in very mundane ways. It began with a recognition on the part of Americans that slavery was an unacceptable evil in our young country. And in the modern era, it is difficult for any of us who grew up as Americans, any of us who grew up in the Western world, to even imagine the concept of owning somebody. Slavery is a thoroughly alien idea to us because we value people. We value lives. And we recognize the value and the beauty in every human life, no matter where they, you know, no matter where they come from, no matter what their beliefs are, etc. We value other people. In the South, in the 1850s, in the 1840s, and certainly before that, there were people who thought slavery was evil. But there were also a lot of very wealthy people who had become wealthy by virtue of being able to own their workers. Slavery in the United States grows out of the English tradition of indentured servitude. And indentured servitude was basically a way for people who had no money to either pay off their debts, pay their passage to the New World, or obtain land. So as an indentured servant, you would basically offer yourself to a business owner or a farm owner or somebody with money, somebody with a need for labor. And you would say, I will work for you for free for X amount of time. And at the end of that period of time, you will grant me an acre of land, or you will pay for my passage to the New World. I want to go see what's going on in America. I can't afford a ticket. You buy my ticket. I'll come work for you for free for 2 years, and then I'm off on my own. This was an unfair system, obviously. But it was a system that managed to propagate itself for a certain period of time. Ultimately, indentured servitude fell out of favor. And the reason it fell out of favor, partly, was because the slave trade found its way into the United States of America. So if you are the plantation owner, if you are the farmer, why would you enter into an indentured servitude contract to somebody where you're going to have to give them something at the end of it? You're gonna have to give them money, or you're gonna have to give them land, or you're gonna have to give them something, when you can just buy slaves and keep them and keep their children, or sell them when you have too many, and never have to pay for labor ever again. This is how the South was built. After the Revolutionary War, this is how the agricultural South made its bones, on the backs of slave labor. This was seen in the North, rightfully so, as inhumane, as cruel, as evil. If you have seen the film 12 Years a Slave, if you can bring yourself to sit through that movie, you get a sense of what was going on in the South. If you have seen Django Unchained, as much as it is a grindhouse revenge film, there is a fair amount of fact, historical fact, mingling with Quentin Tarantino's fiction. Okay? Slavery was not, as some would have you believe, people living in houses on the farms and working every day and having free time at night. Slavery was brutal. Slavery ripped families apart. Slaves were beaten. Slaves were killed. Slaves were raped. And the people who were perpetuating this system were perfectly happy to keep it going because they had internalized a belief that the slave was less valuable as a human being than they were. People in the North who were less dependent on agriculture, less dependent on slave labor, quickly came to realize how evil this was. And they began first by outlawing slavery in the northern states. And the southern states looked at that and said, fine, your state, you're free to do whatever you want to do. They then proceeded to start offering sanctuary to freed slaves. This is the Underground Railroad, which many of us around here are very familiar with. Okay, there are Underground Railroad stops all around Massachusetts, all around New England. So if slaves could escape from the South, we would give them full citizenship up here in the North. Slaves who fought during the Revolutionary War were given citizenship, but only in the North. Anyone who tried to stay in the South as a freedman found themselves driven away. So the North is opposed to slavery. The South is in favor of slavery. And for the North, the question becomes, how do we get rid of this? How do we solve this problem? How do we do away with slavery entirely? So in addition to the Underground Railroad, which is a thorn in the side of the South, they are also trying to get a resolution passed. I mean, there have been, in addition to that, there's various ways that they're harassing the slave owners and harassing the slave states. People are filing lawsuits. People are trying to get the federal government involved because the country at that point is more or less split evenly between northern states and southern states. The federal government is not doing much. So the northern states start pushing this idea because America has bought or won through blood and warfare pretty big chunks of land. Okay, the continental United States in 1860 does not look too different from the continental United States of today. Most of the same territory is under our control, but very little of it has actually turned into new states. We know that a lot of new states are coming. People know that a lot of new states are coming. So the Northerners are pushing for a resolution from the federal government that will outlaw slavery in new states. Any new state that joins the Union must, as a condition of its admission to the Union, ban slavery. And what the North thinks is that by doing this, they will confine slavery to this one little pocket in these 14-odd southern states where it will slowly wither and die, where the moderate voices, the progressive voices who are opposed to slavery, will eventually win out over a dwindling number of plantation owners who still see slavery as their only means of operating their businesses. So in looking at this and in understanding this, all of which has happened prior to the election of Abraham Lincoln, which is still critical, and I will get to that in a moment. But what we see in this are three things, three factors that you need to have a civil war. Number one, you have to have a deeply divisive issue. You have to have an issue that is so passionately felt and so deeply internalized that the people who have entrenched themselves on the opposite sides of that issue can never be swayed. can never be moved to think about it differently. The Southern slave owner is never going to give up his slaves. The Northerner is never going to give up the idea that slavery is immoral and evil. That's factor one, a deeply divisive issue. Factor number two is people who are willing to sacrifice themselves in support of their view. And we saw this in the North with the Underground Railroad. We saw people who would put their lives on the line to go down into the South and free slaves and rescue slaves. We saw it in the slaves themselves who risked death trying to escape that Southern system. For the slave owners themselves, there wasn't as much risk other than someone is going to come along and tell me I can't do this anymore. And then we get to factor number three. Factor number one, you need a deeply divisive issue. Factor two, you need people who will sacrifice themselves to support their side of that issue. Factor number three is the most interesting of all, because there are a lot of issues that are deeply divisive where you can find handfuls of people who will sacrifice themselves. Okay, somebody who will go out and shoot an abortion doctor, regardless of the consequences, is an example of someone who has a deeply held issue that they're willing to sacrifice themselves for. But they don't have a big movement behind them. And the reason they don't have a big movement behind them is because of factor number three. Now, you may have learned in school, depending on where you went to school, that the Civil War was about slavery. You may have learned that the Civil War, the American Civil War, was about states' rights. This is a popular theory in the South, that the Civil War was really about states' rights and the ability of states to determine for themselves what their rules would be, and the ability of states to say, you know what, I've had enough of this United States thing, I'm going to walk away. I'm going to take my ball and go home, and I'm going to do my own thing over here. The states' rights argument is a bit of a half-truth, because the slavery argument is a bit of a half-truth. The reality is somewhere in between the two. Slavery was a root cause of the Civil War. But slavery was a symptom of a broader disease. And that broader disease that existed in the United States at the time of the Civil War was racism. That was a broader disease that allowed slavery to flourish. Because in order for one person to own another person, you have to adopt some sort of a racist mindset that basically says, what I'm doing here is just and right. And I'm not saying everyone in the South was racist. I'm not calling all white people racist. None of that. What I'm saying is that slavery as an institution is a symptom of a disease, which is racism. And that disease of racism, because remember, around 1860, the United States is more or less split in half. Half the country's the northern states, half the country's the southern states. Very different economies, very different ways of life. Almost like two entirely different countries existing side by side. Because of that split, and because that disease of racism had infected our federal government, we come to the third factor needed for a civil war, and that is a weak federal government. And the federal government was weak because the founding fathers had built it to be weak. When the founding fathers are drafting the Constitution of the United States of America, there are a large number of delegates sitting in the Constitutional Convention saying, we just lost a war to the British monarchy. We are not going to create an American monarchy. We are not going to install any kind of a government that has the ability to dictate our daily lives. They wanted the benefits of a federal government. They liked the idea of the federal government raising the army. They liked infrastructure. They liked the common currency. What they didn't like was this idea that the federal government would ever tell them what they could and couldn't do, how they could and could not run their businesses. So at the time that the Civil War is actually starting, long before Lincoln is elected, long before Fort Sumter, the federal government is weak in the sense that it can neither compel the states to stay within the Union, short of military force, nor can it exert any sort of pressure over the rights of the states. We're all sort of hanging out in this thing together and saying, we like aspects of this, but you keep your government over there. So the federal government is weak. So we have a deeply divisive issue. We have people who are willing to die for their stand, for their belief on either side of that issue. And we have a weak federal government. Those three conditions conspire to set the United States on a course for disaster. Because the North is a little more populous, the North has an easier time electing presidential candidates than the South does. The South had been able to install several presidents early on. But as we get into the middle part of the 19th century, we start to see candidates from the Midwest and candidates from the North advancing in Washington. And they are bringing with them Yankee progressive politics that are hated in the South, precisely because they are opposed to slavery. So when Abraham Lincoln runs for president, Abraham Lincoln includes in his platform a promise that he will require a ban on slavery in all new states entering the Union. So if you want to become part of the United States, you can't have slavery. You have to outlaw it. You have to ban it. And the southern states look at this and they understand what's happening. They see what's going on. They see the fingerprints of the hated Yankee progressives who are simply trying to free slaves. They see the fingerprints of the hated Yankee progressives all over Lincoln's platform. They, of course, try and elect a Southern candidate who will maintain the status quo. Lincoln wins. No sooner does Lincoln win than the Confederate States of America is born. Because they now understand that if they're going to be allowed to have slaves, if they're going to be allowed to keep the plantation system operating, they are not going to be able to do it under the laws of the United States of America. And they invoke states' rights. They invoke this idea that we are free to walk away from this thing. We're free to walk away from you Northerners, you money-counting Northerners, who just sit around counting money all day long. Your bankers and your fishermen and your craftsmen and your furniture makers and all you idiots. We're down here doing the actual work. We're actually feeding the nation. You don't understand how our business works. And you do not have any right, Yankee progressive Northerner, to tell me, Southern farmer, how I'm going to run my business. In fact, what you are suggesting is going to put me out of business. I cannot grow food. I cannot grow cotton. I cannot do anything if I don't have slaves. So the South sees the election of Lincoln as an existential threat to their economy. And they are already dug in on this issue of slavery. And it is at this point that they realize they are willing to die for those principles. They are willing to die to preserve their right to own other people. You hear that today and it sounds like utter madness. You know, yes, I will lay my life down so I can have a slave. Really? That is not a hill that anyone is going to die on in the 21st century. But back in the 19th century, that's where we were. Because the plantation owners, the farmers in the South, believed that the end of slavery would end their way of life. That they would no longer be able to do what they do. That they would lose their plantations, lose their capital, lose their businesses, lose their money, lose their influence. They would lose everything. And that is the point where they dug in. The people in the North were on the right side of history. We know this. They were on the right side of humanity. We know this. Many people, not everyone in the South, by the way, supported the Confederacy. And that's an important thing to remember. There were a lot of people in the South who were like, you know, slavery's bad. We don't like it. Just let's end slavery. Let's get back with the United States. Let's move forward. And you'll hear sometimes in stories about the Civil War, stories about families being torn apart and brother versus brother. Well, this wasn't, you know, one brother's in the North and one brother's in the South, and they're on different sides. This was people in the South within the same family. People in the South went to join the Union. And there were some Northerners that went to join the South and wound up on opposite sides of the battlefield shooting at each other or stabbing each other with swords. Killing each other. Because you had three things. You had an issue, a deeply divisive issue. People willing to die, willing to sacrifice themselves for their side of that issue, and a weak central government. The central government may be the most important factor of all in this. And it's important to understand that prior to the American Civil War, there had been no real existential threat to the Union. There had been no issue so divisive that a large number of states threatened to walk away. There had been divisive issues. There had been disagreements. The South didn't like the North. The North didn't like the South. They took advantage of opportunities to harass each other, depending on who was in power in the federal government. Same sort of things that we see going on today. They looked at the North as a bunch of money counters. People in the North looked at the South as a bunch of ignorant farmers. And there was no conversation. There was no cooperation. It is us versus them. But for most issues, that worked. And the country was pretty evenly balanced up until Lincoln's election, up until all of these new states were going to come in. And the South realized when all these new states come in, the balance shifts and we're on the losing side. So either we take our stand now or our way of life is gone. Then the attack on Fort Sumter happens. After secession has been declared, after Lincoln has been elected, after Lincoln has pledged to support this idea that slavery must be banned in all new states entering the United States. So if you want to know what the Civil War really was about, it was about a United States political candidate saying, I support a ban on slavery in the territories. That's the spark that sets everything else in motion. That's the moment where the Civil War begins. And it actually begins even a little further before that. But that's the moment when everybody sort of stops and looks and says, hang on a second, this is real now. It's the moment when the side that hasn't been fighting back against the oppression realizes they have to fight back and suddenly has skin in the game. That's how we get to the first Civil War in the United States of America. Now, why do I bring this up? Why is this relevant? If you asked anybody in America in the years since the Civil War, since we dragged the South kicking and screaming back into the Union at the barrel of a gun, would there be anything else that could shatter the Union? Would there be a states' rights issue that could shatter the Union? And I think the answer that pretty much every American would give you is no. No, there is really nothing in our current life, in our current world, in the world that we've inhabited since the 1870s, that has been such a big deal that we were like, no, you know, we have to break off with the rest of America because we're going the wrong way. There's too much about America that we like. Okay, some of it is things that they liked before the first Civil War. We like the common currency. We like the military. We like that our government takes care of foreign relations for us so that as individual states, we don't have to worry about that. We like having this massive free trade zone that makes us the largest economy in the world. Even if China's catching up to us, we're still number one right now. We like interstates. We like being able to get in our car and drive from one end of this country to another. We like that you can move from Massachusetts to Montana, to Nebraska, to Texas, to Nevada. Nobody's going to say a word. Everybody's going to be like, hey, you're an American. Welcome. Come on in. We like all of that. And we like all of that, and we like our fellow Americans enough that the things that divide us aren't enough for large groups of people to say, we need to end this America thing right now. And we've had some pretty divisive issues since then. We had the McCarthy hearings, the communist witch hunt in the 1950s. We had World War II. We had the assassination of John F. Kennedy, the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, the assassination of Martin Luther King. We had the Vietnam War. We've had Roe versus Wade. We've had gay marriage. All of these are divisive issues for different groups for different reasons. But at no point has anyone sat around and looked around and said, geez, we ought to leave the United States over this. Nobody's willing to take it that far. Because collectively, after the American Civil War, the federal government stopped being weak. So you may still have two of those three factors. You may still have a deeply divisive issue. You may have people who are willing to sacrifice themselves for their beliefs. But we had a strong central government as far as keeping everything else in check went. You know, we can think of it as a stool. And you need the three legs of the stool for the stool to stand up. And because we know now that if push comes to shove, the federal government will roll out the military to bring renegade states back in, everybody now looks at the possibility of leaving the United States, particularly for a narrow political issue, and says, no, not worth it. Not worth it. We will fight in Congress. We will fight in the Supreme Court. We will fight in the White House. But we are not going to fight amongst ourselves on a battlefield over these issues. So I think it's fair to conclude and reasonable to conclude that there are no states' right issue will ever sever the union in the United States ever again. With some imagination, you could think of something extraordinary. Something truly extraordinary that might lead us to that place. And an example I could give, if the Yellowstone supervolcano went off and obliterated a third of the country and left Nevada and California completely landlocked on the other side of a wasteland, those states might decide to leave because they no longer had access to the infrastructure or any of the benefits of the United States of America. That's a scenario where you might see a split in the union. You'd also be down all of the states in between. If someone found, you know, $50 trillion worth of diamonds sitting under the New Mexico desert and decided they were going to go start their own country, that would theoretically split the union. If the space aliens came down and decided they were going to set up shop in North and South Dakota and not talk to anybody else and not share their technology with anybody else and turn North and South Dakota into a new alien paradise where every American who was living there was thriving, but there wasn't enough to go around, that might split up the Union, especially if the aliens come with weapons that our military is afraid of. But absent something fantastical like that, the Yellowstone volcano is more likely than those other scenarios. But absent anything fantastical like that, I think we can safely say that there is no states' rights issue. There is no general political issue. There is no government-facing issue that would split the United States of America. We will let the courts decide. We will let Congress decide. We will let our government, our strong central government, do its job, and we will abide by those decisions even if we sometimes hate them. Because the alternative is unthinkable. Trying to rally enough people in your state and then rally enough people in enough states to launch a serious challenge to the United States military is pretty much off the table. So you will not have a civil war in the United States based on states' rights. We have passed that existential test. That is not the only existential test that exists. And I bring this up tonight because the next couple of topics I am going to bring up tonight tie into this idea, this belief that I am reluctantly coming to, and sadly coming to. It gives me no joy to talk in these terms. Those of you who've listened to me for any amount of time know I am not someone who is given to hyperbole. I am not someone who is given to wild flights of imagination when we discuss issues. I am not someone who is here to frighten you. I have nothing to sell. I get no benefit from scaring you or saying things are bad or saying things are dangerous. So if I am putting forward an idea, it is reasoned, it is logical, and it is based on really a tremendous amount of observation, months, years, and looking at patterns, and looking at trends, and looking at where things are going. And the conclusion that I can only come to at this point is that the second American Civil War has begun. I'm going to let that sit with you for a second. And you can mark down your calendar August 8th, 2018, as the first time you heard somebody behind a microphone say this to you. The second American Civil War has begun. And as I said earlier in the show, the first American Civil War did not begin at Fort Sumter. It did not begin with shooting. It began with a lot of maneuvering and a lot of posturing and a lot of things that built up to the moment when the shooting began. And as I said, there are three conditions, three things that you need. It is a stool. The stool needs three legs to stand. And those three things are a deeply divisive issue, people willing to sacrifice themselves for their beliefs, and a weak central government. What I also said is that it would not be about states' rights, because I don't think we will ever have a civil war about states' rights in this country ever again. We could, however, easily have a civil war about personal rights and individual rights, and in particular, the First Amendment. What we are seeing in America right now, playing out primarily online, but also in other forms of media, has been characterized as polarization. They tell you America's deeply divided. We're divided on the issues. We're polarized. Again, it's a half-truth. We are deeply divided on a lot of political issues. But that in and of itself is not a problem. That is normal. That is the status quo for America. For as long as there have been two people on this planet who are humans, there has been a deep disagreement about something. It's what we do as humans. It's our nature. We have different likes. We have different desires. We have different needs. You put two people in a room, I don't care how good friends they are, you dig deep enough, sooner or later you will find something that they disagree violently over. They may never act out that violence toward one another, but the nature of the hostility of the disagreement can be described as violent. The issue that we have before us in this country right now is free speech. Whether or not we will be allowed to say what we want to say without fear of violence, without fear of reprisal, without fear of censure, without fear of censorship, without fear of losing our jobs, without fear of being ostracized from society. Whether or not we will be allowed to speak our minds in the public square. This is a deeply divisive issue, and this is alarming. Because what has happened over the last 6 years, by my count, is when it 6 years ago is probably when it really started to become noticeable, is that a pernicious fascism has enveloped a segment of the United States population. And we see it when riots break out on college campuses, when somebody shows up to give a speech. We see it when riots break out over social issues. We see it when people attack each other over social issues. There is one side that believes certain things simply should not be said. Certain ideas should not be expressed. That should all be scrubbed from our public discourse. And if you are one of those people bold enough or stupid enough to make one of those statements, you should be erased. You should be silenced. Because you are a racist, you are a homophobe, you are anti-Islamist. You can be anti-Semitic in all of this, by the way. That's okay. You can be anti-Christian, that's okay. You can be anti-white, that's okay. But these people on the far left and their enablers in the media would have you believe that all manner of speech that they disagree with comes from Nazis and comes from authoritarians and comes, ironically, from fascists, and that those voices should be forever silenced. And that the people, not only should the voices be silenced, but these people should lose their jobs. These people should lose their livelihoods. These people should be driven from public. I don't know where. It's America. I don't know where you're going to send them. They should be hounded out of restaurants. They should be hounded out of stores. They should be beaten up at gas stations. They should be beaten up at comic book conventions. This is what these people believe. And there is a violent streak and a fascist streak in what they're putting forward. And the people who are the victims of this, the people who are simply trying to have a discussion, the people who are simply trying to put an idea together or a thought together, as correct or as incorrect as it may be, really haven't been fighting back. They are the South in our Civil War I analogy. Because they've been sitting there watching all of this build up, watching all of this happen, and basically saying, you know what? This doesn't affect me. This too shall pass. This will go away. These people will calm down, and I can just get back to my business. Maybe I got to lay low for a little while. Maybe I ought to keep my mouth shut for a little while. But all I got to do is wait it out, and this will go away, and we'll get the America that I know back. That would be the case if we had a strong central government. But when it comes to this issue of personal expression, of freedom of speech, of the desire of some to drive others out of the public square, the federal government is weak. And not only is it weak, in some cases, it is aiding and abetting those who would seek to silence debate in this country. So we have the three factors, the three legs that will support the stool. We have a deeply divisive issue, which, by the way, is not gay marriage. It is not diversity in film. It is not equal representation in the workplace. It is not equal pay. It is not any of these things. It is something far more fundamental, something far more basic, something I would go as far as to say is primal for an American citizen. It is the First Amendment. It is our right to freedom of speech. We have a divisive issue in freedom of speech. We have a divide in this country where a growing number of people think freedom of speech ought to be ended because they don't like some of the speech that they're hearing. We have people who are willing to sacrifice themselves for this. If you saw the footage from Portland, Oregon this past weekend, you know what I'm talking about. And at some point in the future, I will talk about groups like the Proud Boys, what they really are and what they're really doing. Because what they really are and what they're really doing is calling attention to Antifa. Calling attention to the fact that these guys show up to have a march and Antifa shows up with their bats and their bricks and their body armor and starts beating people up as the police stand by and watch. You have people on both sides of the issue who are willing to sacrifice themselves. Not in huge numbers. We haven't lit the fuse yet. As I mentioned, you look at Portland, Oregon, police are standing by. Governor of Oregon, or the mayor in Oregon, did nothing to stop that ICE protest that was going on. Mayor also happens to be the chief of police. That's convenient. Divisive issue, people willing to sacrifice themselves, and a weak central government. This is a recipe for disaster in the United States of America. The second American Civil War has begun. And this one may never be a shooting war. Although there will certainly be shots fired. There certainly will be casualties. The problem is you can't draw battle lines for individual rights. There's no north and south when it comes to personal rights. Okay, people who are opposed to free speech live next door to people who are in favor of free speech. This isn't a regional issue. You can get your armies together and you can go fight it out on the streets of Portland or fight it out on the streets of Charlotte or fight it out anywhere you want in the country. Maybe start killing each other. But you're never going to see grand battles. You don't solve this one by rolling in a bunch of tanks and telling everybody to go home. You don't win this one by burning down Atlanta. The only way that you solve this is with a strong federal government. But when it comes to these issues of freedom of speech, the federal government has become very, very weak. Because the federal government has not adapted itself to the tools people are using to express themselves. They are way behind the curve, as are we all, in figuring out what it means to even have freedom of speech in the 21st century when we live in a world of Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and the newspaper is dying. private companies now control the flow of information and claim that they're not publishers. And those private companies wield a tremendous amount of influence over our daily lives and do not do it with our best interests in mind. They do it with their self-interests in mind. And the next two things that I am going to talk about tonight tie directly into this. I have given you my opinion, my belief, my fear that the second American Civil War has begun. In a little bit, I am going to give you the evidence that anybody can look at, that has been in the news lately, that has been talked about, that will prove, I believe, the point that I'm making. But before that, you might want to know what the weather is going to do.
No why. There's no sun up in the sky. Stormy weather.
Your Boston 5-day forecast is, I'm going to extend it. I'm going to tell you it's garbage as far as the eye can see. Here's what we got, folks. Thunderstorm's going to be blowing through tonight. I still haven't seen anything heavy in this area right around the coast, which probably means we're not going to get the really heavy thunderstorms, but don't rule it out. Showers around all night long, lows around 75 degrees. Tomorrow, partly cloudy, maybe a shower in the morning. High around 90 degrees. Humid. Here's that word again. Low in the low 70s. Friday is your winner. Friday is your pick of the next 20-odd days. High in the mid-80s, low humidity. Noticeably lower humidity, by the way. Lows in the upper 60s on Friday night. Saturday, scattered thunderstorms move in. High in the mid-70s, low in the upper 60s. Sunday, more thunderstorms and showers early in the morning. Then that's going to break out of here. We'll get some partly sunny skies. Highs in the mid-60s, lows in the upper 60s. Highs on Sunday in the mid-70s, lows in the upper 60s. Monday, clouds, high around 80, lows in the 70s. Humid. Tuesday, more humid, scattered thunderstorms, high around 80. Wednesday of next week, humid, scattered thunderstorms, high of 85, and so on and so on and so on. I am looking ahead to August 22nd, and it is still humid. So that's what we're dealing with. Kind of a turkey weekend if you got the vacation time this weekend. So you might want to go out Friday. You know, Friday's going to be the winner. Sunday afternoon should be nice, but Friday is going to be your pick for the outdoor activities. 855-915-9636 is the telephone number. 855-915-WMFO. When we come back, the internet has struck down a voice. We'll talk about that and what it means here on WMFO Medford.
Any time is a good time for broiling thick, juicy steaks, indoors or out. What kind of steaks? Tenderloin, porterhouse, T-bone, sirloin, or rib steaks. They're all naturally tender and excellent for broiling in the top USDA quality grades, prime, choice, and good. Prime is the top grade, and choice is almost as high in quality. For more information, write How to Buy Meat, Agriculture Radio, Washington, 20250.
A ranger station.
I'd like to report a bear hug.
Okay.
I put out my campfire and Smokey Bear hugged me.
So you drowned the fire, you stirred it, drowned it again, and felt that it was cold?
Uh-huh.
Yep, he's just letting you know you did good.
Bear hug from Smokey Bear. Status update.
I'm gonna let you go now.
There are many ways to start a fire, but one sure way to put it out. Learn how you can do your part at SmokeyBear.com.
Sponsored by the U.S. Forest Service Ad Council and your state forester.
My
WMFO Medford, 91.5 FM. It is The Big Picture. I am Derek Gary with you until 9 o'clock tonight when On the Town with Mikey D comes here with everything you need to know about the Boston music scene. 855-915-9636 is the telephone number. And I get no joy from this next story, but it is one that must be talked about. Alex Jones is a stain on journalism. Alex Jones is a stain on the broadcast media. Alex Jones is a craven opportunist who built his broadcasting empire. This guy is a failed broadcaster. That's what Alex Jones is. Alex Jones is a guy who couldn't hack it, couldn't cut it, couldn't actually cultivate or build an audience of rational thinking people. So he made his name and built his empire off of 9/11 conspiracy theories. Alex Jones was one of the first to come out with the 9/11 was an inside job. 9/11 was a false flag operation line of thinking. That became a very popular cottage industry and remains a popular cottage industry to this day. Alex Jones has since doubled down on his opportunistic broadcasting, claiming that the Sandy Hook massacre was staged, that the families who lost children, 5 and 6 year old children at Sandy Hook, were actors. He is a loathsome, loathsome individual. And as an American citizen, you are free to never listen to Alex Jones. You are free to never care about Alex Jones. But our First Amendment also says Alex Jones is free to go spew his poison into our atmosphere. And he is free to go find an audience if he wants to. Alex Jones is the kind of guy who, in the days before the internet, probably would have had a newsletter typed on letter-sized paper, advertised in the back of some magazine somewhere, Soldier of Fortune or High Times or the National Lampoon, and you'd send Alex Jones $10, and several times a year you would get photocopied, typewritten pages where he would expound upon his beliefs, lay out his manifesto, and try and convince you that the sky is purple. That's not the world we live in anymore. We now live in a world of quote-unquote publishing platforms that theoretically give every American the ability to become a broadcaster. This is still a country where very few Americans, less than 1% of us, have the opportunity to do what I do, which is to sit behind a microphone attached to an actual transmitter and broadcast. Most people aren't doing that anymore. And they aren't doing that anymore because they don't have to. They can go find an audience on YouTube. They can get 100,000, 200,000, maybe a million people to watch them on YouTube. They can get millions of people to follow them on Twitter. They can upload their podcasts to Apple and get hundreds of thousands of downloads. And they can monetize it all themselves. By the way, most people who do this and have access to a microphone get paid. I don't. Just throwing that out, that's just an aside. It's not relevant to anything. This is WMFO Medford. So Alex Jones has all these tools available to him, as we all do. Alex Jones, in the wake of Parkland